Hey, this is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G podcast. One of my favorite things I get to do on this show is hear from our listeners and answer their burning questions about all sorts of things, including work, life, school, you name it. And this summer, we're bringing back the hits and covering some of our favorite questions and takes. We're talking business, career advice, and even hearing a brand new, never been aired interview about parenthood. So tune into the Best of Office Hours, a special series from the Prop G podcast sponsored by Mint Mobile. You can find it on the Prop G feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Maybe you're the outdoorsy type who thrives in inclement weather and unsavory circumstances. But that doesn't mean you can't enjoy a little luxury while you're on the road. Introducing the Defender 110, a luxury vehicle that was built for the modern explorer. An impressive cargo capacity means plenty of room for gear, and their innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, drive the Defender with confidence. A vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Welcome to Switched On Pop. I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
And I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
Charlie, I'm not sure how much time you've spent on the internet recently.
Apple tells me my weekly usage. I'm kind of ashamed.
Would you describe yourself as chronically online?
Not chronically, but unhealthfully, perhaps.
Well, I'm curious if you've come across a viral video set to an unforgettable song referred to by the website knowyourmeme.com as simply, quote, nerdy white boy dancing to Nasty.
I've not seen this one. Is somebody
gonna match my freak? Can you describe what we're seeing here?
Some very loose hips. Lots of whining.
Lots of whining, yes. The dance hall movement, known for its seductive nature.
He's got moves, what can I say?
I feel like this guy weirdly looks like me, and it turns out his name is also Nate, which is kind of wild.
Oh, boy. So you've now been red-pilled into internet conspiracy theories via the Nasty white boy dance, just to be clear.
Perhaps.
Okay.
I mean, this was originally done to a Soca track and then overdubbed with the song Nasty, which then went viral. And while this video may be a modern classic, I'm more interested in the music we're hearing.
The conspiracy deepens. Tinashe's Nasty, so minimal, so seductive.
Yes, this track, Nasty, you've just identified, it's by the R&B singer and songwriter Tinashe. It is a jam in its own right. It's not just a piece of viral content. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the songs of the summer.
Surely.
It's a chance for a burgeoning artist to reach a new level of success. Mm. It's a commentary on contemporary gender politics and the latest in a long line of pop songs taking the term nasty and spinning it on its head. Is somebody gonna match my nasty? I got stamina, they say I'm an athlete. By the time this episode drops, Tinashe will be out with a new album called Quantum Baby, and it might be a new step in this artist's career as well. So today I want to go deep into the nasty verse. And then when we emerge, I want to step back a little because this is a song that in some ways is ridiculously simple.
Yeah.
Right? I've been a nasty girl, nasty.
Yes, you have, Nate.
And the simplicity of pop music has been in the news recently because a few weeks ago, a scientific study was published arguing that pop hits have become less complex over time.
Scandalous.
So at the end of this episode, we'll dig into those findings and see if we agree with their conclusion. But first, Charlie, are you going to match my freak?
I'll get my freak on with you.
I've been a nasty, nasty, nasty.
Charles, if we're going to learn to appreciate the magic of this song, we have to start by getting to know its performer.
Okay.
Now, Tinashe has some level of fame. According to Spotify right now, she is the 458th biggest artist in the world.
Not bad.
The top 500.
Yeah.
But I feel like this track Nasty might catapult her into another level of fame. The song is currently, appropriately, at number 69 on the Billboard Hot 100.
34, 35. Wow.
I'm sorry. I know this is a family-friendly show, but I mean, it just writes itself. And it's her first solo song to crack the Hot 100. And she's been at this for over a decade. So this is like a big accomplishment for Tinashe. Who is she? She's Tinashe Jorgensen Kachingwe. She grew up in Pasadena. Got a shout out Pasadena. That's where I live.
The land of nasty freaks and cul-de-sacs.
She's got a really interesting story. She was a child actor, including a run as the girlfriend of the kid on Two and a Half Men.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Charlie Harper. This is Jake. We live next door. Right, Jake?
I'm Jake.
Hi, I'm Celeste.
I'm Jake.
She had a brief turn in the girl group, The Stunners, which also included in its membership Hayley Kiyoko, another artist who's gone on to have a pretty successful solo career. After leaving that group, she taught herself how to produce beats, how to record and engineer her vocals. And shortly after, she debuted a new sound, dark, moody, sensual R&B, a sound exemplified by her first song to really permeate the cultural consciousness, Two On, featuring Schoolboy Q, which went to number 24 on the Hot 100 in 2014.
Cool. Yeah, sort of crossover hip-hop beats, really simple, very sensual lyric and vocal styling. Nice sound.
And there's a little bit of an edge, which I feel like you can hear a decade later in Nasty as well.
Oh, yeah. Is somebody gonna match my freak?
Need somebody with a good technique. After the success of Two On, Tinashe went on to become a reliable source of introspective R&B over the course of 6 studio albums and 4 mixtapes. And in her live performances, she became known for incredibly athletic, impeccable choreography, something I experienced firsthand a few years ago when I saw her at the music festival This Ain't No Picnic in Pasadena, California. And I was like blown away by her breath control performing one of her songs, Save Room for Us. She was basically doing Olympic level breakdancing while also nailing every single note. Just save room for us. Hi,
just you come back for us. And just to be clear, you mean like gold medalist Olympic breakdancing, not Australian.
Not Australian breakdancing. Yes, important, caveat, because I'm, oh man. Yeah.
That's an interesting song to really move to because the vocal is quite quiet and breathy. And to be able to sing actually quietly while also exerting yourself is very challenging. But I guess as she says in Nasty, she's got stamina. She's an athlete.
Yes.
I got stamina. They say I'm an athlete.
Yes, she is a tireless artist. In a recent profile in The Cut, our friend, the journalist Kat Zhang, called her, quote, infuriatingly competent, which I thought was a really great description. Huh. I also learned in that profile that she has a black belt in Taekwondo.
This is cool. Okay, so she's an athlete and she's super competent. I think we hear that lyrically as well in Nasty. You know, there's this line where she says, pillow talking got my throat raspy. Pillow talking got my throat raspy, which is a really great detail. You know, when you talk way too low like this, it's actually really bad for your voice, and eventually you gotta lose your voice. And so perhaps that breathy quality that we hear in her performance is being summoned through these lyrics.
Oh yeah, being that sensual and sexy takes a lot of work.
But it's competent writing. It's really, it's very detail oriented, sense engaging writing in a song that seems relatively simple.
And I think her moment to break through has been simmering for a while. And I think it's really interesting that it's this song that has sort of crested into another strata of success and recognition, because this song, Nasty, taps into a deeper vein of music history, from Janet Jackson to Destiny's Child and beyond music into the world of politics.
Okay, so this is when we enter the Nasty verse?
Yes, and we need to begin by getting deeper into this track, written by Tinashe and the producer Ricky Reed, a guest
friend of the pod.
I know you say friend of the pod a lot. I feel like that's he was on the pod.
Ricky Reed is good friends with my former next door neighbor in Los Angeles, so I think by the transitive property we're good friends.
Okay, we'll count it. Acquaintance of the pod. How about that?
Okay, yeah.
Neighbor of the pod. Super accomplished producer who made this track with Zach Seacoff. In an interview with Variety, Tinashe said that she actually came up with this lyrical concept as she was driving to the studio to meet up with Ricky. Her nickname, she said, is Nasty Nashe. So she was like kind of using that as inspiration, and she was in her car coming up with these lines. I've been a nasty girl. Is somebody gonna match my freak? And then she got to the studio and she told Ricky, I want like a weird beat. I want something a little outre and off the wall. And this is what they came up with together.
Yeah, super simple. The construction of this song is actually mostly just sine waves. The 808 kick drum that we hear is actually a sine wave just pitched to create a little thump sound, and we hear that 808 bass line moving around, jumping between octaves. Then we have a very simple keyboard pad sound, which is also created from really basic sine waves. And so the core of this track is the most fundamental sound that can be made.
So it's very kind of elemental, maybe even a little bit primal in a way.
It's the building blocks of sound.
And talk about building blocks, that chorus line, I've been a nasty girl, I've been a nasty girl, nasty. It also feels very elemental because they chop her saying nasty and then tie it back in at the end of the phrase. So it's like not only are you hearing this chorus line over and over again, you're hearing the exact same intonation of that word, nasty. There's no variation. So it becomes almost this like this mantra or this invocation. This is like the nasty doxology here or something. I counted it up. There are 33 nasties in this song. That's a lot.
Yeah, her being chopped up saying nasty over and over again makes her almost more like part of the rhythm section.
I love that. Yeah.
She's being sampled, not necessarily performing that moment each time. And it creates a nice contrast to when we do start to hear more of her spoken, raspy, breathy voice.
Another kind of weird, unsettling element are the harmonies in this chorus, which move from a B minor chord to a G minor chord. Charlie, a few weeks ago, you played me a track from Charlie XCX's album Brat called I Might Say Something Stupid.
I might say something stupid.
And you're talking about how part of the power of that track was this kind of weird chromatic chord progression. Well, this chord progression in Nasty uses exactly the same movement. And I couldn't resist making a little kind of jazzy version of this progression for you. I mean, that is such a weird, funky progression. And it seems so fitting for this song. It's like a nasty chord progression, honestly, is what it is.
Ooh,
it's a nasty progression.
It's crunchy. I think it's more than just a nasty, crunchy chord progression. I think it's also saying this is a dance song because it points to a style of harmony which really develops in dance music when, back in the day, writing a dance track, you likely had a monophonic synthesizer, a synthesizer that could only play one note at a time. But it had what you would call three oscillators, and you could tune them around, and you could actually tune a chord. But if you moved that chord across the keyboard, it would be the same exact chord. Like, you couldn't make it major on one note and then minor on another without retuning it. And so you hear this sort of planal harmony of the same chord being played over and over throughout all kinds of house tracks because you were limited by the simplicity of your synthesizer. And actually, that's exactly what we're hearing on Tinashe's Nasty. It's actually a tuned chord playing on one note, and they're moving that note around, shifting that chord around in space, meaning we're always in that sort of B minor-y feel.
So whether we're aware of it or not, hearing that progression kind of taps us into this deeper well of dance music history.
Yeah, it's like, get your freak on, we're going to dance.
And this song is instantly quotable, right? Mm. Is somebody going to match my freak? Like, that's part of the lexicon now. Mm-hmm. People are going to be saying that in, like, UN Security Council meetings in 10 years.
I mean, if Kamala is brat, then the UN can be freaky.
And the song is sexual, clearly. I mean, yeah. That probably needs no elucidation. Mm-hmm. And yet, I also feel, despite all this sparseness, this harshness, this nastiness, there's also a certain tenderness in the song. And that really comes through in the sung chorus. Please, if you keep up with me,
yeah, it's such a reprieve from the repetitiveness of our little nasty mantra. She feels like she's really breaking out. The vocal almost steps forward. Mm-hmm. It's very intimate. The production changes.
It's a little more lush.
The harmony changes. Yeah.
It's a little more like plaintive and yearning almost. Uh-huh. Right? She sings about, if you keep this up, I'm going to get attached. There's like the emotional side of being a nasty girl here that we get to see. It's a little vulnerable.
Yeah, this is like hookup culture isn't so simple. Feels can be had.
And then just when the feelings get too much, the track contracts. The chords and the bass all strip away and we're back to this sparse nastiness.
Yeah.
So with all these brilliant lyrical production harmonic choices, I think we can understand why this song is having such a moment right now. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also the fact that it's leaning into this deeper tradition of artists, especially Black female R&B artists, reclaiming the word nasty.
Mm. Where does that word even come from?
Well, Charlie, I thought you might ask this. So I did a little etymological dive.
Yeah.
And there's not consensus on where the word nasty came from.
Yeah.
One suggestion is that it emerged from the old French nostre, which means malicious and spiteful.
Okay.
But I did think you'd appreciate this description from 1872 by a European traveler in the United States discussing its use in the country. Quote, "Nasty, in England, frequently meaning ill-tempered or cross-gained, and in this sense admitted into good society, denotes in America something disgusting in point of smell, taste, or even moral character, and is not considered a proper word to be used in the presence of ladies." So in England, you could say nasty and it wouldn't make anyone clutch their pearls, but he's saying in America, it has this other connotation. It's like a dirty word. You don't say it in the presence of ladies.
I wonder if that's because it became sexualized. It became a taboo word somehow.
Well, he says it has to do with moral character. So maybe there was a layer of that involved. Mm. But
yeah, the Puritans.
But that unladylike context of the word might be important when we fast forward like a century later and we find Janet Jackson recording her album Control in 1986 with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. And she wanted to turn this word nasty on its head because she'd been having some experiences. She'd been stalked and threatened by men on the street. And here's what she said, Charlie. Quote, "Instead of running to Jimmy or Terry for protection, I took a stand. I backed them down. That's how songs like Nasty were born, out of a sense of self-defense."
I'm totally hearing how Tinashe is in the lineage of Janet's Nasty, because the beat, the production, the harmonies, the counter melody, they are all so nasty.
Yeah.
Like they totally. Are the onomatopoeia yes. of the title. Like yeah. they just are uncomfortable, a little dirty, a little stanky.
It's got this propulsive new jack swing beat. And as you said, it hits hard. Every Janet Jackson vocal and every snare drum hit feels like a punch to the chest. Some moments of the song almost sound like industrial, like the outro. I feel like you could headbang to this.
And there's that great moment at the end, though, that she's showing this sort of contrast of the expectations between what it means to be nasty and what it means to be ladylike, because she shifts from these very sort of spoken and almost screamed-like vocal into a, "Hey, ladies," this beautiful sort of like R&B backup girl group singing style.
Yeah, there's some continuum here with Tinashe, but at the same time, there's a different approach to nastiness. It's kind of a negative thing, except for maybe one moment in the bridge, which might be one of the most iconic moments in the song. Because privacy is my middle name, my last name is Control. No, my first name ain't Baby, it's Janet, Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
Which shows that there are multiple usages of the word nasty here. There are the nasty boys or the nasty girls, but then there's also, well, maybe you like to get nasty.
Yeah, I'm on the fence over how to read this. Is it like, only call me... If you're a nasty boy, then you don't get to call me Janet. Right. You have to call me Miss Jackson. Or is it like a kind of an invitation to get nasty with me and call me Miss Jackson? Like, I don't know exactly how to... It's a little opaque.
It is. Perhaps intentionally. Leave us guessing.
So Janet Jackson's Nasty is a landmark track in the Nasty verse. And when we get to 2001, we find another song that uses this nasty term. But instead of... in an empowering way, it kind of uses it to shame and take aim at other women. I'm talking about Destiny's Child's Nasty Girl. You nasty girl, you nasty, you trashy, you classless girl, you sleazy, you freaky, put some clothes on, girl. Whoa.
Okay, this is getting a little bit shamey here.
Yes, I was surprised given how we perceive Beyonce as this avatar of sexual freedom to hear her in 2001 being like, put some clothes on, you're dressing like a skank. Basically, you're nasty.
It's kind of like... The scrubs hang out with the nasty girls, to take us back to that era.
And to be clear, she's doing it with her customary virtuosity. Like the run she does on the line, "I never met a girl that does the things that you do."
Yeah, she's not pulling back any punches right now.
It's not Shine Theory. It's not like, let me lift up all the women. In fact, in the music video, they have a scene where there's a line of girls who go through a machine called the Nasty Zapper, which transforms them into women with better clothes. And then they get to join Destiny's Child in the dance party.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like it could be heard that we are now entering into the world of like morality policing within lyrics. And I just want to say, I think that what is great about this word nasty is its broad potential usage. Like, we've all known nasty people, good and bad. I mean, Nate Nasty Sloan, you take those glasses off.
Nasty Nate. Yeah.
You're a totally different person.
Wow, that's wild to hear you say that, because there was a period in time after the movie Half-Baked came out. I don't know if you recall that one with Dave Chappelle.
Sure, yeah.
Which had a character called Nasty Nate in it, and a lot of people started to call me that afterwards. Did not stick, you know, thankfully, but maybe it's time I reclaim that.
Yeah. It's come back round, if you ask me. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I hear what you're saying, Charlie, and I feel like this term nasty has had so many different meanings, and it had a big shift in 2016 during the third presidential debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. He famously called her a nasty woman. And that line, those two words, became a rallying cry. They were chanted in protests across the country. They were used in fundraisers. There were whole, like, t-shirt lines devoted to promoting the phrase nasty woman.
Yeah.
There was the sense that we can retake this word and reinscribe it so that it can't be used against us.
Huh.
And I feel like some of the music that emerges out of that has a new approach to nasty, like Ariana Grande's 2020 song of the same name. Don't wanna wait on it tonight, I wanna get nasty. Nasty now is empowerment. It's sensual. It's got agency. And I think that brings us back to Tinashe.
She's taking ownership.
It's the final form of nasty, perhaps.
It's no longer lewd to use in the presence of women. Women like Tinashe are claiming that term as their own.
Exactly. And they're doing so in a way that is kind of plain as day. There's not a lot of subtext. As we said, this song is very simple in some ways. Mm-hmm. Is it too simple, Charlie? Is its simplicity a sign of something bigger that's happening within the world of pop music? A new study argues yes, but are we going to match its freak? Find out after the break.
Hey, Sue Bird here.
I'm Megan Rapinoe.
Women's sports are reaching new heights these days, and there's so much to talk about. So Megan and I are launching a podcast where we're going to deep dive into all things sports, and then some. We're calling it A Touch More. Because women's sports is everything. Pop culture, economics, politics, you name it. And there's no better folks than us to talk about what happens on the court or on the field and everywhere else, too. And we'll have a whole bunch of friends on the show to help us break things down. We're talking athletes, actors, comedians, maybe even our moms.
That'd be a fun episode.
Whether it's breaking down the biggest games or discussing the latest headlines, we'll be bringing a touch more insight into the world of sports and beyond. Follow A Touch More wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Wednesday.
Legend has it that John Muir spent a summer befriending grizzlies in the Sierra Nevadas. Bear Grylls once crossed the North Atlantic in an inflatable boat. The most devout adventurers will always find a way to push themselves, to go farther, stay longer, and push harder. And now there's a luxury vehicle that can keep up. The Defender 110. Built with integrity and robust materials, the Defender 110 was designed for the modern explorer. An impressive cargo capacity means plenty of room for gear, and innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. The powerful innovations like intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. Whatever your lifestyle, the Defender family has a model to fit. There's the two-door Defender 90 for a smaller crew, or the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. A vehicle made to go further, the Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
The Walt Disney Company is a sprawling business. It's got movie studios, theme parks, cable networks, a streaming service. It's a lot. So it can be hard to find just the right person to lead it all.
When you have a leader with the singularly creative mind and leadership that Walt Disney had, it like goes away and disappears. I mean, you can expect what will happen.
The problem is, Disney CEOs have trouble letting go. After 15 years, Bob Iger finally handed off the reins in 2020. His retirement did not last long.
He now has a big black mark on his legacy because after pushing back his retirement over and over again, when he finally did choose a successor, it didn't go well for anybody involved.
And of course, now there's a sort of a bake-off going on. Everybody watching, who could it be? I don't think there's anyone where it's like the obvious no-brainer. That's not the case.
I'm Joe Adalian. Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network present Land of the Giants, The Disney Dilemma. Follow wherever you listen to hear new episodes every Wednesday.
All right, Charles, a few weeks ago, I got a flurry of texts from friends and family.
Yeah.
And they all had a link to this new study that was written up in the New York Times, reported on in NPR, and a number of other outlets, all with some variation of the same headline. Is pop music getting simpler? Question mark. These stories were based on a scientific study published in Scientific Reports in July 2024, which used mathematical models and algorithms to argue that melodies in pop music have become more simple, less complex.
Okay.
Particularly in the domains of rhythm and pitch.
I'm skeptical here.
You're raising an eyebrow.
Yeah.
Let me tell you a little bit more about the study.
Yeah.
The corpus it used for analysis was the top five Billboard songs every year from 1950 to 2023.
That's a weird data set.
It's a small one. It's only five songs every year. It's not.
And sometimes the top five are so all over the place and disconnected and unrelated. I don't know. Okay.
Some more skepticism.
I'm not a statistician. I don't know what the proper end value is here.
Sure.
Yeah.
The study used eight melodic metrics, four related to rhythm and four related to pitch, for each melody from the Billboard song. So reducing the song just to a single line, essentially. That is to say, removing all the other elements of the song, harmony, timbre, vocal approach, lyrics, etc. Just looking at the melody itself.
Yeah.
The do do dee do do, if you would.
That's a little bit more 18th century than 20th century, but okay.
Da 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 da. How about that?
Lovely.
Some of the parameters they used were the number of notes per bar and the average melodic interval between different pitches.
Okay.
Another way they measured complexity and simplicity was with a statistical model that detected how predictable a melody was. So essentially, they developed this algorithm that would guess which note should occur in a melody based on the previous notes in the melody, and then measuring how unexpected the next note was.
Okay.
If it's more unexpected, it has a higher level of complexity.
I'm still raising my eyebrows, just to be clear.
I think this is a very difficult thing to pull off, to say we can objectively measure melodic complexity.
Yeah, I even prefer perhaps the word complexity to simplicity. Like, simplicity infers melodies have gotten dumb. I think we need to be really careful with the words that we choose that can apply any kind of subjectivity to music is better or worse. So back this up more. Like, do we have examples?
I thought we could take a song from one of the more complex periods in the study. Paul Simon's Still Crazy After All These Years from 1975.
I met my old lover on the street last night. She seemed so glad to see me. I just smiled. And And we talked about some old times, and we drank ourselves some beers. Still crazy after all these years. Oh, still crazy after all these years.
The thing is, it's not the melody that stands out to me, it's the chord progression. This is one of the most beautiful chord progressions of all time. It uses secondary dominance, it uses chromatic passing chords, it uses all kinds of diminished chords and borrowed chords from the minor key. It's very harmonically sophisticated.
Well, that's exactly why I wanted to use this song, because I agree. I play it on piano, and these harmonies are so chromatic and unexpected. But the melody is just a pentatonic line. It's only using five notes.
Oh.
And I would say if you remove it from the harmony, it actually sounds very expected, very repetitious. But this all gets complicated when we get to the bridge of the song.
Four in the morning, crapped out, yawning, longing my life away.
Have we gone into another key now?
We've modulated to a new key, and then we modulate to another key, and that key is a half step below the key that we started in. It's really hard to sing. It's really unexpected. I imagine this would make these scientists' melody meter just start, like, going beeping off the charts.
Right, right, right. And to be clear, one of the things that harmony allows us to do is it can take us into sort of new colors of sound. If we're so happily in one key, if you make the right kind of pivot chord, you can end up in an entirely different, unexpected key where now your melodies might be transposed up just a half step in a way that would have been entirely unpredictable by these statistical models, but make a lot of sense within the context of the chords.
So there's a few things happening in this example. I think one is the difficulty of measuring melodic complexity.
Yeah.
Because even within a single song, you might have sections that are incredibly simple, then become incredibly complex, and then goes back. And it's like, well, how do you assign like a value to that? But on the other hand, I do step back and I say, I haven't encountered a lot of pop songs since we started doing this show a decade ago that have a modulation to a key a half step away.
No, it's unusual. And again, I think, one, Paul Simon is a little bit of an outlier, but also that songwriting styles and expectations were different in that era, where long evolving chord progressions were expected. They were a part of the musical grammar. And as more production became influenced by hip-hop and moved more towards computers, sophisticated loop-based production that might privilege unique soundscapes and timbres became the norm, while chords became perhaps a little bit simpler, or at least would maybe loop throughout the entire song, thus leading the melody to sort of stay within the same range throughout the entire song.
And this is what I want to talk about next, because the study has these findings that there are three melodic revolutions that occur where there's a dramatic drop in musical complexity. And they occur in 1975, 1996, and 2000. And in a way, I would almost put those two second ones together, just call it like, you know, late 90s or something.
Sure.
But if we think about those eras, I do think they correspond to exactly what you were just describing. 1975, that's kind of a moment where dance music takes over the charts, right? Disco becomes probably the most popular genre in the United States, which is all about these more long-form, repetitive structures that give you ample room for bodily expression and are less about these mm-hmm. convoluted, meandering, harmonically complex melodies.
I would rather dance the Sheik than Paul Simon. Sorry, Paul.
And then if we're looking at 2000 as another benchmark, well, that's right. that digital revolution that you were just discussing.
And also the moment that hip-hop becomes the dominant pop form and every genre starts looking towards hip-hop. Hip-hop often being sample-based or made with samplers and computers would often create beats that are structured around some sort of foundational loop. And that is the style of songwriting now, really across almost every single genre. You can hear it in pop, R&B, country. It's everywhere.
And that raises another question that I couldn't really find addressed in the study. What do we do with melodies that don't have pitches? What do we do with a rapped, spoken melody?
Right.
Certainly, it could have an incredible amount of timbral variance and rhythmic complexity. Does that make it into the study? I'm not sure based on what I read.
Or even, you know, the study looked at how simple the rhythms of these melodies are, right?
Yes.
If you look at some of the best rappers in the business, oftentimes they will intentionally keep their rhythmic cadence exactly the same. And what is interesting become the moments that are stressed, the unique approaches to rhyme,
yes.
where we shift from end rhymes to interior rhymes, multisyllabic rhymes, while maintaining the exact same rhythm, is an incredibly sophisticated and complex way of writing lyric. It's very satisfying to the ear because there is, on one level, really complex rhyme schemes and metaphor set against this very persistent, almost like military drum line like rhythm.
Right. Can we accurately gauge the complexity of a melody without referencing its lyrics? Or is that
right.
inherently doing a disservice to the melody to begin with? These are questions that will keep us up at night, I think.
I feel like if you want to answer this question, I would like to see something like the harmony is held constant so that songs compared from the 1960s to today would have to have the same amount of harmonic complexity and then examine, are the melodies more complex within simple harmonically based songs or do they vary? I think you might also have to pull out songs that are primarily rap based, which are going to skew the data. So I think that it's very clear that tastes change, that the way that we write changes, that where complexity happens shifts from one musical function to another, like from melody to harmony or to rhythm, or et cetera, to timbre, arrangement, et cetera, et cetera. Like disco arrangements are incredibly lush and complex, even though the beat is very simple, right? Hip hop drum quantization is a specialty that you can study a PhD in and write a book about how Jay Dilla swings the beat.
Right.
Right. There is complexity. So my understanding is that the authors of the study didn't try to say that music has gotten simpler, but rather that some of the headlines about this study have inferred this because it's a bit salacious and, you know, it's exciting to say pop music is dumber today than it was when you liked pop music.
Right. And I feel like every year there's a new one of these studies.
Yeah.
A headline that says songs have stupider lyrics. Songs are sadder. Songs are shorter.
Yeah.
And they all may have sound methodology and be based in concrete observation. But but there is this sense that we're trying to prove something about pop music. The hypothesis is always that pop music is worse than it used to be, frankly.
Right, right, right. And everyone who is conducting these studies have gotten a PhD, which means they're at least in their late 20s. And we know that musical taste hardens right before then. That like our peak tastes are between age 14 and like 24, 25. By age 30, we stop listening to new music unless we did listen to podcasts like Switched on Pop to continue our musical journeys.
Good plug.
It's very common that we just stop listening to new things and we want to remember why our favorite thing was the best. I don't mean to throw anyone under the bus, but recently I got a text from one of our colleagues that was like, Charlie, music from the 90s was definitively better, right? And I'm like, colleague, I love you and I love your tastes, but we can't say that.
It is tempting to make those kind of judgments, but it's hard to make them hold up under scrutiny. And I agree with what you were saying, Charlie. I would love to see a study that's like, how can we measure the ways that pop music has become more complex and rich? How can we do a timbral analysis, like a rhythmic lyrical analysis, like you're describing? Those Those studies would be very illuminating.
I want to be the contrarian voice here and say that we all know that there is more music being released every day than any other point in history, which means that music is probably more complex and more rich than it has been at any other point in human history. It might just not be properly captured in the top five songs on Billboard in a statistical study that looks at one element of music. Music is complex, it is rich, and it represents people in so many different ways, especially like when they want to get nasty. Switched on Pop is produced by Rana Cruz, edited by Art Chung, engineered by Brandon McFarlane, illustrations by Iris Gottlieb. Nishat Kroa is our executive producer, a member of the Vox Media Podcast Network, and a production of Vulture and New York Magazine. You can subscribe to New York Magazine at nymag.com/pod.
Find us on social media at Switched on Pop and tell us what is the nastiest part of nasty that you're getting nasty to, and what are the nastiest nasty pop hits in history that you love to get nasty to. Nasty, 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 nasty. What else? We have a new episode coming out next week, next Tuesday. Brand new nastiness for you on the pod.
It's gonna be about one of the biggest pop stars of the moment.
Will it be nasty? I don't know.
We'll see. All right, until then,
thanks for listening.
On September 28th, the Global Citizen Festival will gather thousands of people who took action to end extreme poverty. Watch Post Malone, Doja Cat, Lisa, Jelly Roll, and Rauw Alejandro as they take the stage with world leaders and activists to defeat poverty, defend the planet, and demand equity. Download the Global Citizen app to watch live. Learn more at globalcitizen.org/vox.
Attention adventurers. Just because you're comfortable roughing it in the woods doesn't mean you can't drive there in style and comfort. Introducing the Defender 110, a luxury vehicle that was built for the modern explorer. An impressive cargo capacity means plenty of room for gear, and innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. Whatever your lifestyle, the Defender family has a model to fit. There's the two-door Defender 90 for a smaller crew, or the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. A vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.